I, Libertine, Chapter 6.
I would like to speak to Miss Axelrod, Pendleton.
Yes, Captain. I'll see if she's at home.
Come here.
Yes, sir?
If Miss Axelrod is not at home, I shall wait. If Miss Axelrod says she is not at home, she shall not see me again.
Yes, sir. Will you wait in the library?
Lance strode across the great foyer to the double doors of the famous Blanton Library. Walking from the hall was like coming in from outdoors. The open space there, with its great double staircase and arched skylights, make one totally unprepared for the library. It was a wide room, but the ceiling was so low that tall men habitually leaned with their hands easily on the beams overhead. Its decor was as luminous, dark, and green and cream, and books from floor to ceiling, save for doors, windows, and fireplace. Books in a star-shaped rack, free of the wall. Books in racks angling out and back from the wall. There were coves, caves, and nooks of books. Lance walked softly among them, occasionally touching morocco, calfskin, ivory inlay on the backs of the books. He quickly learned the arrangement. They were beautifully organized, and with the greatest pleasure he stopped before as complete a little library of the law as the most exacting barrister might wish. One title in it made him laugh. He put out his hand for it, then checked himself. Time enough for that later.
"He sends me fierce messages by the butler," said Miss Axelrod from the door, "and I find him in the shadows laughing like a wicked imp. You know, you quite frightened me, Captain."
In her blush-pink velvet she looked anything but frightened. He caught her hand and kissed her wrist. Then, holding it, he put out his other hand to touch the lobe of her strange ear. She stood quite still at this, her welcoming smile still on her face, neither responding nor repulsing. This reminded him of something which he chased from his mind before it could be identified. Faced with control of that high order, he suddenly understood the passion of some men for the unmarked, the inscrutable. To see such a mask was to want it contorted, sweat-sheened and mobile. But these were the thoughts of the libertine, and there was no room for him.
"Never a time for him, never a place," he sighed to himself.
"I sigh for love, I die for love," she sang softly, a coquettish rendition of the more shallow ballads of the moment. But he cut it right off when he said, unsmiling,
"I sigh for satisfaction, my dear. I have found you out."
"Whatever do you mean?"
"I shall never tell you."
He looked her in the face, and then paced off, so that he might smile unseen at the sudden distraction in her eyes. "Suggest to your enemy that his secret is yours, and whether it is yours or not, whether or not he has a secret, he will fear you for it."
"Thank you, Signor Gracian."
He turned back, and said in businesslike tones,
"Miss Axelrod, I have come to report to you on the matter we discussed."
"To report progress, Captain Courtney?"
"Completion, Miss Axelrod."
"Well, I think we had better be seated and discuss this thing, then."
"I should like Miss Chudley to be present at any such discussion."
"Why, we needn't trouble her,"
she smiled.
"We shouldn't burden you and you alone with it, either."
"You do not fully understand my relationship to Miss Chudley,"
she said with a certain amount of warmth.
"On the contrary, Miss Axelrod, I understand it all too well. If you will permit me an analogy, I could, in fairness, compare you ladies to a government, rather like that of our ally, the great Frederick of Prussia. There is a head of state, whose function it is to set policy. Then there is a body to carry it out. I would liken you, Miss Axelrod, to the latter."
Two bright spots appeared on her cheek, though her half-smile was still as soft, and her eyes as clear.
A party, Captain, too?
And what I have to propose, he said quickly and loudly, will, I am certain, quite certain, call for a policy decision. Do you follow me?
Surely that would be for me to judge of anyone, Captain,
she said sharply, and then, between breaths, she was standing close to him, with her hands on his elbows.
Lance, she said very softly, Lance, I do not want to quarrel.
He moved back.
We need not quarrel, Miss Axelrood.
He smiled tightly.
You gratify me by using my given name. Do you feel you know me well enough?
At the moment, she said candidly, I feel I do not know you at all.
I cannot say why,
he said offhandedly,
but I suddenly recall a piece of news. My old acquaintance, Lancaster Higger Pigott, the lawyer's lad, is no more.
Oh?
She said.
And at the same time Mr. Barrowbridge, alas, passed away.
Barrowbridge? Dead?
Sepulchrally, yet smiling, he said,
he will practice no longer in Bermondsey. But, of course, these are my personal concerns, and I should not trouble you with them, but perhaps their passing has made a change in me.
You mourn them?
She inquired, a quiet sparkle in her eyes.
I cannot. I am so deeply convinced they are going on to better things.
Her laughter finally escaped her. It had apparently been building for some moments, and he laughed with her, their eyes meeting. This was a dangerous playmate for sure, but it was a pleasure to joust with her on any field.
"Tell me about that conviction," she said.
"Ah, these are the matters I felt should be discussed with Miss Chudley."
"Miss Chudley has gone to visit a friend."
"May we expect her back presently?"
"I think not."
He pondered that and then shrugged.
"A pity. It could only mean that this interchange must be accomplished twice, and will therefore take longer. Not that it matters to me. The urgency, as I understand it, is Miss Chudley's."
She inclined her head.
"The matter is urgent. Will you tell me what you mean? Have you really found a course of action for her, in the matter of Mr. Hervey?"
"I have. There is only one thing I must be sure of. Perhaps I should not ask, and perhaps you should not tell me."
"Please, ask anything."
"Thank you. Mr. Hervey, the Earl of Bristol's brother, would he oppose or favour an action which would eliminate this reputed marriage to Miss Chudley?"
"Favour it, with all his heart. More so with every passing minute," she said positively. "He will not, however, accept such a remedy as an action for divorce, nor would his brother the Earl."
"Very good, then. With his agreement, we can make a positive solution. Absolute."
"You are most elusive," she remarked, "in the matter of describing the solution."
"I quite agree," he said and smiled. "You shall have it in time. At the moment, however, I would far rather discuss certain other things. You mentioned, I seem to recall, something about a little townhouse in Holborn, and a number of activities this would make possible."
She moved to an ottoman and sat down upon it, indicating by a graceful nod that she wished him to take the chair by it. He sat down, watching her carefully, and just as carefully she said,
"I should very much dislike it, Captain, if this conversation should reach an impasse. The matter you have brought up is rather completely dependent upon the solution you say you have found. You give me to understand you will not divulge it. In all fairness, isn't it previous to discuss matters which can only follow the solution?"
"Just exactly the tact Barrowbridge said they take," he thought with satisfaction. He smiled. "I had no intention of discussing the house in Holborn, Miss Axelrood. Actually, no one has offered me such a thing, and should anyone do so, I would unquestionably decline it."
"Decline it?"
For a moment her containment fell away, and her mouth opened prettily.
Then, what do you want?
He placed an expression of horror upon his face and threw up his hands.
Why, Miss Axelrod!
But at the same time he winked. She made an amused mew at having been so badly caught blurting out a straight question in this curled conversation, and again they had that moment of locked glances, of complete understanding and mutual approving disapproval. He said,
"You have quite captivated me, you and Miss Chudley. You have suggested that I might help you, and that I am prepared and empowered to do so. But I should feel a cad indeed if I am limited my assistance to the triviality we have discussed. I can be of much more help to you. As a matter of fact, unless I give you the L, I think you will find the inch quite useless."
Miss Axelrod put her cheek in her palm and looked up through her lashes.
"My, you do go on," she murmured. "But go on."
"Thank you. Now, stated simply, the situation is this. Miss Chudley wishes a clear-cut annulment of these rumours. She wishes this because she and the Duke of Kingston would like the freedom to wed. Surely no one would oppose such a splendid union."
"Surely not."
His eyes widened, and he stabbed a forefinger down at her.
"You are wrong."
She was puzzled.
I don't follow you, Lance. The Duke is the last of his line. He has no legitimate issue, and the title would die with him unless, of course. But I hardly think there would be any issue of this marriage."
"Quite probably not. But that's beside the point. Yes, the title's finished, but what about the estates?"
"What about his estates?"
"Come now, Miss Axelrod. With all the thinking you have done about this situation, you have surely not overlooked that."
When she kept looking at him blankly, he said, speaking slowly as if to a child,
"If, God forbid, the Duke should die tomorrow, who would inherit?"
I'm not sure," she answered. "Someone in the collateral lines, I imagine, but—"
"Do you suppose yourself in the shoes of that someone in the collateral lines? Do you think the Duke's death would find that someone unaware of his rights? Don't you think he is at this very moment aware of what's coming to him when the time arrives?"
I suppose not, but you keep talking about what happens when the Duke passes on, and the matter in hand is not that, but his marriage." "Oh!"
she squeaked, and put a hand to her mouth.
"And so it comes to you."
He nodded approvingly, deeply enjoying his moment of patronization.
"There is indeed someone who would, at the very hint of a rumour that Elizabeth Chudley was free to take his place as next heir, cause much embarrassment, so much that even though her current situation was cleared up, the marriage might be made impossible. Poor Miss Chudley, to have come so far, and to be so near her greatest desire."
"Oh, dear. I suppose... Well, Captain Machiavelli, that you will prudently conceal the name of this potential heir, and stow it in the chicken run."
"By no means, my dear. His name is Meadows."
"Oh, good heavens! The nephew! That hideous little stick-in-the-mud! All godly and duty-bound. I met him once. Charles, I think."
"It is not. Charles is abroad. It is Evelyn, the other nephew, named after his uncle the Duke. I assure you, as fully aware of Miss Chudley's movements, intentions, and desires as you are, he is a mournful young man of some 30 summers, who has done little for the past 10 years but write bat poetry and hunger for the Kingston lands and holdings."
"Oh, dear,"
said Miss Axelrod again.
"That one, he... But surely you know about him?"
"Actually," said Lance, "I don't, and it doesn't matter. I should say it is far better that way, because I am about to meet that young man, to know him, to become fast friends, and whisk him away with me to my country place, and to keep him interested there until Miss Chudley is free to marry, and does."
She turned upon him quite the strangest gaze he had yet seen in her.
"To keep him interested? How?"
"The resources of human invention are unlimited. My dear departed mentor, Mr. Barrowbridge, used to say there's always a way and always an explanation. All one has to do is think it. Whatever Meadows enjoys, I shall enjoy. Whatever he is seeking, I shall seek. Whatever his need, there shall be more of it with me at my country place than anywhere else he knows." "Why do you laugh?"
he demanded, for she had virtually exploded.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, when she could. She slipped a scrap of lace handkerchief from her bodice and dabbed at her eyes. Inadequately, she explained.
"Lance, dear Lance, it's your approach, your attack, your confidence. They quite take my breath away. Please do proceed."
"That is all, quite all. What are you thinking?"
"I am thinking of what Miss Chudley's feeling will be about this extraordinary plan of campaign."
"And what, in your thoughts, is Miss Chudley saying?"
"She is saying that the whole thing is most ingenious, but that it would be more direct for her to make arrangements about Mr. Meadows without your intervention, once the other matter was in hand. We could not, in all conscience, trouble you quite so much."
"But I would insist. My conscience is equally involved. One must not begin a thing and not finish it. One must not finish a thing anyway but properly. I am involved, Miss Axelrood, and as you pointed out, am quite confident. So much so that I could not countenance having this affair handled in any other way than I propose. I would rather have it not handled at all. I would actually insist that neither Miss Chudley's freedom nor her marriage to the Duke of Kingston occur. Let me put it this way. If Mr. Meadows is present in London at the time of these actions, they cannot succeed. If I am in London at that time, they cannot succeed. How simple, then, how efficient it would be, if while I was keeping Mr. Meadows out of London, Mr. Meadows was keeping me out of London."
"I have never heard of such outright audacity," she breathed.
"Surely you have, and now, Miss Axelrood, you have the sum of my suggestions."
"Suggestions? Captain, is that your word for a demand?"
"A suggestion,"
he said smilingly. She put her hands on her knees with an abrupt soft slap and looked him in the eye, wagging her head in amazement.
"Then it is now my task to tell Miss Chudley that you have found an answer to the matter of her dealings with Mr. Hervey, and that you can thereby free her to marry the Duke, that Mr. Meadows has it in his power to obstruct these matters, and that you volunteer to remove Mr. Meadows from the scene and present him later with a fait accompli, and that you are doing this because of your interest in justice and the right, even to the extent of refusing the house in Holborn."
"I could not have summed it up better myself."
"I think there seems to be something lacking in this picture."
"I think not."
She sat quiet for a moment and then said,
"Oh, the country place. Captain Courtney, tell me about your country place."
"Why," he said offhandedly, "it's the sort of shooting box, you know, nothing elaborate, large enough for a party of, oh, say, six, with a hovel for the servants and a bit of a stable and carriage house, but small enough to be almost lost in a map of England. As I say, nothing elaborate. Comfortable, that's the word, as might suit any young gentleman of reasonable means, excellent background, and favourable prospects."
"Are you suggesting that the Duke might even now have such a holding, and would permit—"
"My dear Miss Axelrood, have I not yet made myself clear? I am not interested in placing myself in anyone's town-house or country place, to live on expectations of my benefactor's continued generosity. Nor would I, in the circumstances, endanger this enterprise of ours by leaving myself and us, all of us, open to such an accusation. Courtney? Ah, yes, the chap who held young Meadows prisoner while his uncle married Miss Chudley. Held him, mind you, at one of the Duke's own properties. Ah, no, Miss Axelrood. The less connection between the parties of this action, and me, the better. If all goes well, and it shall, even Meadows will never be aware that we know one another.
She rose and paced, watching him as she turned and turned again. Then she settled again on the ottoman. "Up to now," she confessed, "I have been willing to hear you out as one listens to a child's story of a dream, only to see how fantastic it can get. But at last I am beginning to feel the substance of your plan. This does not delude me, however, from the fact that you are asking a great deal in return for, well, for your ingenuity, on the grounds that it is simply ingenious. You ask me to take your word for it that the action you have in mind for freeing Miss Chudley will be effective, and also to believe that you can and shall do this, and that, to the end, that you shall have your own country place purchased, no doubt with hard gold sovereigns in your name."
"I would not insist on anything so magnificent," he assured her. "A letter of credit from a commercial bank here would be ample."
He laughed into her amazement until she had to join him.
"As to your accepting my word for all this, of course, I expect nothing of the kind. Has Miss Chudley a solicitor whom she can trust, who has a wide knowledge of the law, and who could be here a week from today to conclude this matter?"
"Yes, I rather think Mr. Beasley would serve," she chuckled. "I think you will astonish Mr. Beasley. What would he be expected to do?"
"First, to inspect my plan for the court action, if, and only if, he agrees that it will succeed, and that the only possible objection to it could be raised by Mr. Meadows, then we may discuss the matter of the shooting-box, the details of which I shall have with me. It would be best if Mr. Beasley could draw up the letter of credit then and there. After that, why, Mr. Beasley may proceed with the case at his earliest convenience, and my good friend Mr. Evelyn Meadows and I shall meanwhile repair to my little place in the Surrey Downs. I think it's the Surrey Downs. Is there anything more to discuss?"
"If there is," she said ruefully, "my poor woolly head will burst at the seams."
"It has been a pleasure to discuss things with your poor woolly head," he said in his rumbling whisper. "I do believe you think as well as a man."
"All women think as well as men. If you had said, 'I think like a man,' however, I would have denied it. Where may I reach you in order to give you Miss Chudley's decision?"
"I may not be reached. Tomorrow morning I am off to look at some holdings, and also to see what can be done immediately in the matter of Mr. Meadows, his joys and preoccupations. I cannot say at this moment where I shall be, except that I shall return here in a week at the same hour, ready to talk to your solicitor."
"And supposing your lofty confidence is misplaced, Captain, and Miss Chudley refuses to pursue your plan?"
"I do not even consider it," he said immediately. "I shall be back here in a week, and should the affair not be concluded at the meeting, I shall not return. The misfortune would be Miss Chudley's and not mine. Now, what is your real name?"
"Lilith," she said immediately.
"Thank you. Ah, Adam's first love, as I remember."
"Yes, and some say the devil's sister."
"You would not tell me before."
"No, but I am coming to like you."
"Then I shall take advantage of that fact and salute it properly."
He quickly slid his arms around her. She put her hands on his shoulders and averted her face, laughing.
"No, please, no."
"Why not?"
"I've told you, I'm coming to like you."
He held her lightly and thought this out, in view of what had passed between them. Was it only last night? Was she no longer? She no longer had her face turned away, but faced him, reading his eyes alertly and with great attention.
"But only last—"
And he could not finish, for she put her hand to his lips.
"I told you you would ask me that again," she whispered. "And I said, too, that the answer was, because I wanted to talk to you."
"Ah, yes. And after understanding that, I was supposed to be angry."
"With yourself."
"I remember."
He put her by and stood up.
"I am to understand that it is not possible for you to talk to me without—"
"It's not possible for a woman to talk to a man, unless it is herself she wishes to talk about, without first bringing about a condition one might call afterwards. Otherwise the very air is befogged with pressures and conjectures, and double entendre, in which the point of any separate discussion may well be lost. So, I wanted to talk with you."
"And yet tonight you—"
"Tonight," said Lilith, "it was you who wanted to talk, and not about me."
"You are very frank."
"You are very angry."
He turned to her hotly, and was met with an expression of such cool amusement, mixed with such genuine liking and admiration, that he stopped short.
"I suppose I am," he floundered. "It's just that I'm unused to— that is, I naturally felt that— what I meant to say is that it isn't you I'm angry at, but— damn it, girl, you're right."
And he began to laugh.
"That's better."
She gave him her long, cool hand.
"I shall miss you, Lance, and though I am, in a way, ranged against you, still I wish you luck. I hope that this whole complicated matter turns out to Miss Chudley's advantage. There are a number of people who would have attempted to best her, and who bitterly regret it."
"My dearest hopes are synonymous with her success," he intoned.
"Get along with you,"
she smiled. He kissed her hand and left the library.
"Pendleton?"
"Yes, Captain."
"My cloak. And is my carriage outside?"
"No, sir. Your coachman asked me to hand this to you."
It was the Hartley threadbare cloak, the Bermondsey cloak, made up into a tight, neat package. Inside one might feel the flat carbon plaques of the Courtney escutcheons. Behind him, Lilith Axelrood made a slight sound. Lance thought an amused sound. He turned. She stood at the foot of the great staircase, ready to mount, one long hand on the newel post.
"So the coachman has passed on too, Captain?"
He had nothing to say. His ears burned redly bright.
"Pendleton, ask Haynes to come round with the trap, and take the captain here where he wants to go. I think he'll remember the way. Good night, Captain."
The butler went away, and Lance Courtney stood in the door, watching the pink flame of her dress rising up the cold white sweep of the stairs.